on my end. One is that we think that the broader issues raised are quite complex and challenging. And we think, given the limited time at our disposal, we should avoid rushing into any policy decisions that set a precedent that will be the basis on which Parliament will operate. So we think that what we should do is, when we report to Parliament on these bills, as part of our reporting, we should set out some of the issues. The second point we want to make is that all parties believe that it's vitally important that the credibility of Parliament be maintained and even elevated. And that is a major consideration that we think should apply when the policy decisions are made within the first 24 months of the new five-year term. Thirdly, we all agree that people have constitutional rights as individuals, and they have to be respected as innocent until proven guilty. Fourthly, there is a consensus emerging, or has already emerged, that it would be unfair and unreasonable to suggest that 250 or so people whose names have appeared on various lists should recuse themselves from participation in this process, especially as the four travel agencies that are accused of accused of fraud or corruption or whatever, all those who were their clients, their names were submitted to the Scorpion, and many of those people did nothing wrong. So you could have had Nelson Mandela and Mahatma Gandhi and Mother Teresa and Martin Luther King in that list. It's just absurd that people of that caliber should be recusing themselves. So we have agreed that at issue are the people who have pleaded guilty, plea bargains, or been found guilty, or are actually facing trial at the moment. In that regard, there are only two members of Parliament so affected in regard to the committees that are considering this bill. Both of them have recused themselves, not for legal reasons, but because the ANC has decided it's politically necessary to do so, only so far at this stage, as it applies to processing the bills. The issue that we have not reached agreement on is there's a further 13 people which the NPA investigated but decided not to proceed with action against. And in regard to these 13 people, the NPA decided not to pursue the matter further and referred it to a parliamentary committee. I think there's a disciplinary committee, a multi-party disciplinary committee that is looking at those cases. It seems to us that at this stage, there is no reason to appoint a senior counsel, as the issues are less legal than issues about values and policies and principles of the different political parties, on which we may not, needless to say, agree. Moreover, we note that Mr. Glenister is going to court on the very issue of these members of Parliament, and in fact a larger number even than those who are the subject of our own consideration in this committee. And ultimately the courts will decide, and therefore too we think at this stage there's no need to have a senior counsel. A proposal was put to the multi-party committee, on which no final decision was taken, that perhaps the ethics committee should look at this issue in the abstract. That means the ethics committee is not meant to investigate each of these 30 individuals, upcoming hearings. We also have a longer document which sets out a summary of the submissions. It's dated Monday, the 25th of August. It deals with all the submissions summarized. At the end of the document is a clause-by-clause consideration of what we got in the submissions, prior to which is the thematic consideration of what people said. Right. We're not going to look at the thick, long document. Yes, we're going to look at the Thursday, 28th of August document. And then what's going to happen is we're going to have the Department of Justice and the SAPS reply. Whatever issues have arisen, and we also have Edward Daniels and his team here, and they will also reply. What I'm suggesting is that I understand that Christine and Impumelelo and PC will be dealing with this from the research unit. Christine will take us through the document, and PC will help in reply to the questions that might arise. I think the best way for us of quickly doing it is, if you look at the document, it's got the following things: constitutional issues. The second one is international obligations. The third one is parliamentary process. Four is accountability to minister. Five is status of new units. Six is multiple agencies, that is independent. Seven is problems with the SAPS. Eight is mandates. Nine is integrated methodology. Where are we? 10 is powers and functions. That means of the new unit that is proposed. 11 is coordination and oversight. 12 is powers of the national commissioner. 13 is role of the ICD. 14 is Comparefair Commission. 15 is labor issues. 16, I can't seem to find. I'll say 17, budget and assets, and 18, transitional arrangements. Now, what we're going to do is take each issue. Christine and MPC will take us through them, and then we will ask people to respond, the department, DSO, and so on, and see if we clarify the issues and if any consensus. At this stage, no party has taken a formal position on what we do with the scorpions. The program has been agreed to yesterday. No new ideas have come about amending it. So I hand over to Christine to take us through the document. And we're going to seek to, secondly, inform you. I have discussed the Commissioner Gatewell with the committee that next week we will have a report on the organized crime challenges and the nature and form of organized crime. It will be given to the formal committee in open session, but there are also some sensitive issues that I think all parties have agreed that we will discuss consistent with the rules of parliament in a closed meeting. So we will have Commissioner Lala, Mr. Hoffman, a submission you have to give in the open session, and then the more sensitive issues in terms of the rules of parliament, we will have a closed meeting. Okay? So that's that. Can we hand over to Christine?
Given the onerous pressures of work and so on.
guidance from the committee, then shouldn't she take us through the issues fairly carefully but swiftly? Comprehensively but swiftly. Is that agreed? Okay. Because I think let's take it that members, some of us have read it, but others may not have, and to be fair to members, we're sitting in study groups and we're meeting late at night, and it's not reasonable to expect us to have read every line. And I think it's quite important, the constitutional challenge, is to go through it carefully but quickly.
Okay, well, under constitutional issues, we grouped all the general concerns raised by the constitutionality of the bill. So, Helen Susan Foundation, they talk about the bill's breach of the constitution and substantial constitutional principles in terms of the rule of law. They're not linked to a legitimate government purpose. The measures the bill proposed are not congruent with the bill's stated objects. Certain specific constitutional rights are breached. And the state's duty to uphold the constitution is not upheld. And then, that's under the Helen Sussman Foundation. Similarly, the ACDP, they talk about the high crime rate in South Africa is inconsistent with the constitutional rights and the rule of law. And here there's reference to specific sections of the constitution, 10, which is human dignity, 11, which is life, 12, which is freedom of security of person, and 25, which is the right for the right to serve property. The banning of the scorpions is in breach of the constitutional imperatives in sections 198A, which is that national security must reflect the resolve to live as equals and to live in peace and harmony, to be free of fear and want, and to seek a better life. Okay, and these bills will worsen the situation, the current situation, not improve it. There's also reference to the argument that that persons who exercise public power need to be accountable, and in addition, all decisions must be rationally connected to the legitimate government purpose and not arbitrary, otherwise they may be unconstitutional. As with acknowledgement that the DSO has been successful in the fight against organized crime, the decision to disband them is not rational and therefore inconsistent with the principle of legality. And you'll find that theme is really covered by most of the submissions in this regard. Again, Chief Ministers argue that the law violates constitutional rights. In terms of the rule of law, which is the defining value of the constitution, government conduct should not be arbitrary. And that the cabinet has done a vast turn on its initial acceptance of the recommendations of the Campaign Commission, but has offered no reasonable explanation in this regard. The only inference that can be drawn is the decision made at Polokwane by the ANC. Again, reference to the success that the Scorpions have had in fighting corruption and organized crime, and that there's no rational basis for this decision at Polokwane. From that, he infers that the resolution is motivated by the decision of the ANC to protect certain of its members from being investigated. From there, the argument goes that, therefore, the motivation is not connected to a legitimate government purpose, and in fact makes South Africa more vulnerable to organized crime and domestic crime, to international organized and domestic crime syndicates. Then, so the mere act of initiating the legislation contrary to the constitution by undermining the peace and well-being of all those living in South Africa, it violates the constitutional principle of accountability. It was made without due regard to the constituencies the government supports represent, and its reference to the interdict before the constitutional court, and that the parliamentary process should be halted until the judgment. The FW de Klerk Foundation, similarly, they say that the reason for dissolving the DSO is the malafide is on bad faith and therefore not legally acceptable. It's based on an incorrect interpretation of Section 179 of the Constitution. or carry out its mandate. It's not in the public interest to give a single police force monopoly on investigating, as it places senior persons in the status above the law. And you'll find that that argument is covered, I think, as well by the CSCR in terms of accountability. The CSCR again talks about the whole thing of equality, and they say SAPS is a large organization, it's difficult subject to scrutiny and oversight, and that very few accountability organizations or agencies, for example, the ICD, have been able to subject SAPS to meaningful oversight or scrutiny. In contrast, the DSO has been relatively effective in subjecting SAPS to scrutiny. Therefore, the disbandment of the structure reduces the accountability and degree to which SAPS members, especially at a senior level, are subject to the law. Then there's reference to the whole thing of police corruption, and they said SAPS suffers from a severe problem with regard to corruption, and the SAPS anti-corruption unit was closed in 2002. There's also a general comment that units involved in investigating organized crime are highly vulnerable to corruption, and the DSO was effectively the only agency outside of the SAPS with the capacity to investigate organized crime at high-level police corruption. Therefore, its closure weakens an already weak mechanism responding to crime police corruption in South Africa. With other official corruption, the closure of the DSO potentially weakens the legal accountability of other senior officials of state. And one reason for this is that the power to initiate criminal investigations is centralized in the staff by the bill. Senior officials in staff are subject to the influence of senior officials, obviously outside of staff and politicians. The existing staff culture is of deference to political authority, which takes precedence over the need to uphold the law. And it's accentuated by a culture of intimidation or resentment within the organization. This is in contrast to the current culture in the DSO. Respect for the law and trust and trust in government institutions. The argument is that although the DSO is not limit-free, its closure will further weaken respect for the law and trust in government institutions. And then with regard to values and culture of law enforcement, the closure of the DSO sends a message to all law enforcement agencies that those who are subject to high-level political and government officials to be investigated, scrutiny will be punished. And this undermines the potential for cultivating a culture within law enforcement agencies that supports the principles of equality before the law and other constitutional principles. Then there's a subheading, and this was to do with the impact of the bills on the NPA. It was saying that a few journalists argued that the decision to initiate this legislation has negatively impacted on the DSO's ability to perform its functions, thereby violating his constitutional rights before the legislation is even enacted. And then it violates Section 179(2) by depriving the NPA of its ability to perform exercise functions without fear, favour, and prejudice. A similar argument is advanced by the F.W. de Klerk Foundation. Just to amplify, the NPA's ability to comply with Section 179 would be compromised, as it would be solely dependent on the investigative resources, more directly answerable to political authorities. Similarly, the similar argument for the Center for Constitutional Rights, and there's a advocate to Bahali, had a slightly different view. She agrees with the Kapese Commission that the law enforcement is not the exclusive function of the police, but disagrees that Section 179(2) permits the prosecution authority to have a law enforcement or an investigative director for those structures. She argues that the prosecutorial powers are distinct from law enforcement powers, and Section 79(1)(2)(b) clearly restricts eventual functions of the prosecuting authority to the institution and conducting of criminal proceedings and not criminal investigations. Before arrest investigations should be strictly in the arena of law enforcement, and during this process the prosecutor's role is only to guide an investigation. These critical roles have to be kept separate in legislation to avoid potential conflicts of interest. And she argues that this anomaly must be removed once and for all. Then with regard to the single police force, DA said there's no weight to the argument around the constitutional requirement for a single police force, and that's the constitutional court's judgment that single does not necessarily mean exclusive. Then we have alternative view, where we have the NK Military Veterans Association, which talks of the Constitution speaks of a single police service, which cannot be realized given the current establishment of the DSO and such. There's unnecessary duplication of functions. Also, the dysfunction between the scorpions and substance resulted in these agencies working in silos, accounting to different political heads, and has created severe tensions between them. So more or less the argument is there hasn't been collaboration and it hasn't worked well. The present arrangement will continue to perpetuate anarchy, and the only remedy is the creation of a single police service. In fact, the dislocation of the is a threat to national security. And then Moshek also refers to this, that the decision to disband the DSO is part of the constitutional imperative for a single national police service with a clear separation of executive, prosecutorial, and intelligence powers. The legislation governing the DSO did not pay proper attention to the democratic checks and balances required by the Constitution, and the DSO uses the doctrine of prosecutorial independence in a way that allows it to be free from direction and control of the executive.
The theme that keeps coming out is legitimate purpose, but it's
for dissolving the DSO appears to be malafides, or at least not a legally acceptable rational purpose, because it's linked to a decision in Polokwane linked to the ANC leadership. I think that should be responded to. They point out that the very different culture in the SAPS of deference to political authority, which takes precedence over the need to uphold the law. Maybe the SAPS wants to respond to that. I think the one that's very interesting, we must respond to it, is the one from the FW de Klerk Foundation. The DSO was established since the entry to carry out the necessary functions, etc. Now, they're arguing the NPA's ability, again, it's very suspect to a non-lawyer. It's very suspect. The argument here is NPA's ability to comply with Section 1794 be compromised if it were to be solely dependent on the investigative resources more directly answerable to political authorities. But before the DSO existed, they were doing exactly that. On international obligations, we've asked the research unit to actually look at this matter and come back to us. There is an argument ever that somehow, if we dissolve the Scorpion, that the UN Anti-Corruption Convention is undermined and so on. Again, I find that difficult to believe as a non-lawyer. However, if we have signed conventions of a specialized organized crime fighting unit, if we do go the route of the DPCI, surely that's covered anyway. Surely the UN conventions are not saying in what form and where it should be located. But here there seems to be a presumption that unless you have a DSO, it's really violating those conventions. We've asked the research unit to come back to us on that, and they're going to do so. But in the meanwhile, we're very keen to hear from you, Enver, on our international obligations. On the single police force, I have to, by the way, there's a piece in the newspapers this morning that, frankly, in my opinion, should have been an opinion piece. It was not a report on what happened yesterday. The writer, the author, actually, that Julius Malema was angrily responding to the chair, so I saw no such anger, but that's fine. It's the right of the journalist to write, but that should be in the opinion section. And the exchange I had with Julius a few minutes after he had finished his elaborate interview with ETV suggested strongly otherwise, but Julius will speak for himself. But also there's just a factual inaccuracy. It's wrong, utterly wrong. Nowhere did either of us say that the ANC Youth League must provide us with a list. How can the ANC Youth League do that? Of informants working within the DSO who came from the old order. No such thing was said. It's really outrageously inaccurate, really. So, can we clarify? What we said was because one of the issues of contention is the relationship between the DSO and certain political agendas, and because the DSO is being constantly accused of harboring, or infested, I think was the word I used, a disproportionately high number of people from the old order, security police, there might be a way out now that it's in the public domain. Will the DSO tell us, and they're going to do that next week, I take it, tell us how many people who are currently employed by the DSO were part of the old security order? We're not asking for names, because we came to some settlement in 1994, and I don't know that we want names at this stage. We simply want to know what percentage came from the old security system, whatever form the security system took. It doesn't mean the security police alone. It means those, what do they call the PW Bota structure? CCB, and then they have that total onslaught structures where the military and structures actually play the security. So the full corpus of security structures within the apartheid system. Can you tell us how many of those currently have in the DSO? Secondly, at what level do you employ them? That is something we're asking you. So I hope that this will be corrected. But on the issue of the single police force, can you explain, Eva, is it correct what I'm constantly hearing, that actually the Constitutional Court itself decided that a single police force meant essentially the banding together, uniting of the forces of the old apartheid Bantustan and so on with the four provinces and so on? Or am I wrong? Did the Constitutional Court say that? Secondly, apparently there's a further legal opinion in a particular case where the same point was made. Have the courts pronounced on that? We are free as individuals and political parties to make a political interpretation of that. But as a committee, we need to know what the Constitutional Court said, if it said anything, and any other court. So that's a quick overview. What I'm trying to help here with the research is that's the sort of thing we're asking for, because we don't want a literal reading. And I can help, and the committee co-chair can help facilitate. I won't be doing this again. I'm just giving Steve and EPC a sense of, you know, like it's an overview of what you've got there. Otherwise, we won't finish. Okay, that said, over then to Emma Daniels, Philip Jacobs, and Yoati Langa to respond.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I'm assisted here today by a number of people from our office. I should apologize for the document which was incorrectly handed out yesterday, because this was a submission prepared by a number of people in our office. A number of technical gremlins crept into the document which we were unable to correct. In fact, even as we talk, we've had to leave certain sections out, but the document I've given to you now is the document we actually
gave. What was the check? Is that?
I apologize for that, but we were simply not able to get rid of the gremlins in the system. Chairperson, but thank you to you and your committee for affording us an opportunity of making the submission. We start off by saying that we certify both bills, that is the NPA Prosecuting Amendment Bill and the South African Police Services Amendment Bill, in accordance with the instructions furnished to the Office by the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development and the South African Police Service and the Rules of Parliament. In the light of the submissions made during public hearings, particularly the suggestions of unconstitutionality, the Office has decided to make the submission to this Portfolio Committee. In making the submission, we explore various themes. These are the process followed by the Office in certifying the bill, the constitutional issues considered, and some of the submissions made by the public. We believe it's necessary to do this, Chairperson, because the constant refrain has been that the bills are unconstitutional. During the certification process, the law advisor considered and tested the bill against the Constitution itself, the principal legislation sought to be amended, relevant case law, and international jurisprudence. The law advisors also refer to academic journals, legal publications, and other relevant instruments. Once the law advisors are satisfied that, in their opinion, the proposed legislation will withstand constitutional muster, they issue a certificate to that effect. If for any reason the law advisors are unable to certify the legislation, they provide Parliament with a certificate to that effect and reasons as to why the law advisors were unable to do so. Given the controversy surrounding the bill, greater than usual attention was paid to these two bills. The public perceptions created suggest that the bills were simply being introduced to give effect to the resolutions adopted by the African National Congress at its national conference held at Polokwane in December 2007. While it is true, Chairperson, that the resolutions pertaining to the so-called scorpions were indeed adopted at Polokwane, it is incorrect to construe those decisions as simply being binding on the state. It goes without saying, Chairperson, that in terms of our constitution, the state does not consist of the ruling party from which it is separated. In other words, the state and the party are two separate and distinct entities. According to our constitution, government is constituted as national, provincial, and local spheres of government, which are distinctive, interdependent, and interrelated. I now turn to the executive authority. The executive authority is vested in the president, who exercises the executive authority together with other members of the cabinet by implementing national legislation, except where the constitution or an act of parliament provides otherwise. Developing and implementing national policy, coordinating the functions of state departments and administration, preparing and initiating legislation, and performing any other effective function provided for in the Constitution or in national legislation. In exercising this authority, the executive is bound only by the Constitution and may make any policy decision it deems necessary. With regard to the NPA and the SAPS Amendment Bill, it is of no consequence that the ANC took various decisions at Polokwane. The general principle that there is a separation between the party and the state applies. Although a decision was taken by the ANC at its national conference in Polokwane, that decision does not impact on the powers of the president and the cabinet, who together exercise the executive authority. Whilst it is not for us to comment on the policy decisions taken by the executive in accordance with its executive authority, the decision is constitutionally sound. The policy in respect of both bills was approved by the cabinet, which also approved the introductions of the bill in parliament. In other words, the legislation was initiated by the cabinet in accordance with the constitution. I now turn to the legislative authority. Our principal submission chairperson, honourable members, is that Parliament may enact any legislation in line with the Constitution. Parliament has the legislative authority conferred on it by the Constitution to pass legislation with regard to various matters and to repeal legislation. Parliament is bound only by the Constitution itself and must act in accordance with and within the limits of that Constitution. Apart from the limits mentioned herein, Parliament is free to enact any legislation it wishes and must follow the rules of Parliament when doing so. Parliament is an organ of state, and as such, the first limitation on its legislative power is to be found in the Constitution itself. Section 44(4) of the Constitution provides that in the exercise of its legislative authority, Parliament is bound by the Constitution and must act in accordance with and within the limits of the Constitution. In particular, the principle of legality demands that Parliament may not exercise a function which falls outside of the Constitution. Such function would be ultra vires and thereby violate the principle of legality. The second limitation on the legislative power is judicial review, set out in Chapter 8 of the Constitution. When the Constitutional Court finds that legislation is inconsistent with the Constitution, it must declare the legislation to be invalid to the extent of the inconsistency, and then make an order which is just and equitable, including an order suspending the declaration of invalidity for any period and on such conditions to allow the competent authority to correct the defect. This means, chairperson, honourable members, in our view, that Parliament is free to pass the bills if it so wishes, without any changes which it may want to make. This freedom and power to legislate was displayed when Parliament dealt originally with the Directorate of Special Operations Bill B39 of 2000. Initially, the Directorate of Special Operations was to be established in terms of the Directorate of Special Operations Bill. It would have been a separate act. During the deliberations on the bill in Parliament, Parliament decided to make provision for this directorate in the NPA Act instead, which was done by way of an amendment to the latter Act. The differences between the two bills, in our view, chairperson, honourable members, were insubstantial, except insofar as the roles of the Minister of Safety and Security in determining priority crimes and the role of the National Commissioner of the South African Police Service in investigations were removed and replaced with other provisions similar in nature. Although the amendment bill appears to encroach on the powers of the police as laid down in Section 199(1) of the Constitution, the law advisers were satisfied that the bill would withstand constitutional muster. In other words, chairperson, honourable members, our constitutional inquiry satisfied us that the establishment of the DSO within the National Prosecuting Authority was not constitutionally offensive. The same observation was made by the Gampepi Commission of Inquiry, which noted that there is nothing unconstitutional in the DSO sharing a mandate with that. We did look at some of the constitutional issues, which we now turn to, and we look at the interpretation of the governing principles in Section 198 and the operation of Sections 205 to 207 of the Constitution. Section 198 stipulates the principles which govern national security and include the resolve of South Africans to live as equals in peace and harmony. Section 199, chairperson, honourable members, seek to regulate the establishment, structuring and conduct of the security services and provide for a single police force, while Sections 205 to 208 deal with the police service itself, political responsibility over the police and control of the police service and the police civilian secretariat. These provisions have been incorrectly interpreted in our view as suggesting that only the police may investigate crime. This interpretation is not necessarily correct, although this theory has not yet been tested in the Constitutional Court, but was examined by the Gampepi Commission as mentioned above. There clearly appear to be compelling reasons why there should be a single police force and why the police should be solely responsible for investigations and to prevent combat crime and to maintain public order, to protect and secure the inhabitants of the Republic and the property, and to uphold and enforce the law in accordance with Section 205(3) of the Constitution. We do not, however, chairperson, honourable members, express any opinion on this. The concept of a single prosecuting authority has been considered by the Constitutional Court and serves as a guide as to how that court will view any argument on a single police force. In Minister of Justice versus Andries Ponsani, the appellants in that matter challenged the military prosecution regime as being inconsistent with Section 179 of the Constitution, which provided for a single prosecution authority. With reference to the governing principles provision in Chapter 11, the court held that single did not mean exclusive. Had the court found that single meant exclusive, then the establishment of any prosecution authority other than the NPA would indeed have been unconstitutional. It is likely, but not certain, that the same reasoning will be applied to any consideration of a single police service by the Constitutional Court. In other words, the Court is likely to find that we may have more than one organization with powers similar to those of the police. We note, Chairperson Honourable Menden, that the Gamkevi Commission, while finding nothing constitutionally offensive about the DSO being located within the NPL, noted the tensions between the DSO and the police and recommended in effect that the responsibility for the DSO's policing function should be transferred to the Minister of Safety and Security. The Commission noted that it was both untenable and anomalous for that Minister of Safety and Security, who has the responsibility to address the overall policing investigative needs and priorities of the Republic, should not exercise any control over the investigative component of the DSO, considering the wide and permissive mandate of the DSO relating to organized crime. In effect, in our view, Chairperson, Honourable Members, the Gamkevi Commission seems to be hovering in the direction of a single police force, although suggesting that the DSO remain where it is currently located within the NPA. The Commission appears to be mindful of the fact that the activities of law enforcement agencies have to be properly coordinated, and that could best be attained by the Minister, by providing the Minister of Safety and Security with oversight functions over the DSO. While the suggestion made by the Commission seems sound, the NPA Amendment Bill and the SAPS Amendment Bill appear to build on the suggestion that the Minister of Safety and Security should exercise political control over the police by creating a new but similar agency within the police service. We considered the NPA Amendment Bill and the SAPS Amendment Bill before they were introduced in Parliament. In our view, Chairperson, Honourable Members, the bills do not offend the relevant provisions of the Constitution in any way which are applicable, and we were able to certify both bills in accordance with the rules of Parliament. Extensive public participation was embarked upon in order to obtain the views of the public, and many submissions were made. We have noted the comments and have responded here to some of those. The comments were, as you know, Chairperson, Honourable Members, extensive, and we could not do justice to this presentation by trying to respond to all of them. Rather, we confine ourselves to what we think are the most important submissions. Before doing so, we make a few general observations about
Edward, can I just ask about process and can I be helped? You see, you're literally reading every word from what I can gather. I had to go out because I had to attend to a practical matter. I'm a bit worried about that. I was wondering whether you couldn't help us, because we can read the text, with the main thematic issues that, you know, what is your response to the view, for example, as the expert here on the single police force? What is your reply, simply? We can check the arguments later. What is your reply to the view that this is linked to, you know, we want you to reply to the things that have come up from the public. So they argue here that it's what? It's not a rational decision linked to a legitimate government purpose and so on. That's what's worrying me a bit. But before I come back to you, can members help me? How do we want to proceed in a way that's comprehensive but expeditious? Can anyone's got a method? Because I don't really know. I'm being unfair to both the researchers and Enver and others. I'm a bit worried about literally reading text. I think it's more summaries we want, but comprehensive. Is there any other method people have got? But reading the text is worrying me, because now we're going to have Philip reading a text, we're going to have Johan reading a text, and it's going to become a text. I'd rather we respond to the issues. Okay, so are we agreeing on that? Okay, so can I help, and then Shlangan will take over after. The question is, on the argument that a lot of people say who want the Scorpion to retake, not a rational decision linked to a legitimate government purpose. Can you deal with that one? And then we ask the other two lawyers to come in.
Can I then suggest that we jump to page 11, Chairperson, and despite your reservations that I'll be allowed to read from page 11, because that covers your principle objection. I then turn to the TSVR argument, Chairperson, Honourable Members. The TSVR submits as follows, that the principle of equality before the law is the central principle of the Constitution. It is affirmed in the preamble and section 9.1 of the Constitution. It is also implicit to the principle of the rule of law, which is one of the founding values of the Republic of South Africa. It is also a key principle of the 1955 Freedom Charter, which states that all shall be equal before the law. While it cannot guarantee equality before the law or absence of political manipulation, our potential to ensure that all people in South Africa are legally accountable will be far greater if we have a diversity of agencies with the capacity to investigate organized crime and corruption. And we emphasize that. Dissolving the DSO will concentrate all crime investigation powers under the SAPS National Commissioner. Investigators who are located in the SAPS and subject to the authority of the SAPS National Commissioner and other senior leaders will not be able to subject the senior officials problems we may be currently, the concentration of investigative powers in the state will dramatically increase the risk of corruption and abuse of power at the higher levels of the state and undermine the potential to address this. The great abuses committed by SAPS under apartheid was facilitated by its monopoly of the policing power. It did not have to fear investigative scrutiny from any other agency. Concentrating investigative power in the SAPS increases the risk of the SAPS also becoming a law unto itself. The legal position with regard to, to the constitutional attack on any legislation that the Republic is incumbent upon us to bring to the attention of this committee, to the provisions of Section 2 of the Constitution, which provides that the Constitution is the supreme law and law of conduct inconsistent with it is invalid and the obligations imposed by it must be fulfilled. Section 2 requires that the conduct of public officials in the Republic must be subjected to the Constitution in order to determine whether the conduct is valid or not. Senior officials of the SAPS, including the National Commissioner, are not exempt from the ambit of the Constitution. Those senior officers are required by Section 2 of the Constitution to adhere to the Constitution and ensure that their conduct is consistent with it. In our respectful view, the CSBR's argument or submission merely points out the problem areas from a practical point of view, which could possibly happen if the intentions of the bills are approved by Parliament and enacted into law and implemented by the government without proper safeguards being in place. This should not, for the reasons that Bondi prevents this committee from approving the bill if it so chooses, as it does not affect the legal validity of the bill. We submit that there are sufficient checks and balances in place to deal with the concerns raised. In the matter of S versus Jordan, the Constitutional Court held that when the court concludes that the provision of a statute limits the constitutional rights, it is necessary first to identify the specific provision of the Constitution that is limited by the impugned sex provision, and second, to determine whether the limitation is justifiable in terms of Section 36 of the Constitution. The same can be said when one seeks to challenge legislation. In this matter, the CSBR has failed to identify the specific provisions of the two bills which it alleges will lead to an infringement of Section 9(1) of the Constitution. On this basis alone, we opine that the CSBR submission cannot be viewed as amounting to a legitimate constitutional attack on the provisions of the bill in question. That is not to say that we feel that the CSBR's concerns should not be noted. As is a constitutional democracy, Parliament and the Executive have a duty to ensure that the provisions of Section 9(1) is fully complied with and that everyone is indeed equal before the law and the right to equal protection and the benefit of the law. In the case of Hugo, the Constitutional Court considered the issue of the right to equality before the law. It stated that the purpose of our new constitutional and democratic order is the establishment of a society in which all human beings will be accorded equal respect regardless of their membership in particular groups. The achievement of such a society in the context of our deeply egalitarian past will not be easy, but that is the goal of the Constitution and should not be forgotten or overlooked. The same principle was developed in Hoxton, and Hoxton, of course, litigated at length against the state chairperson. At the cost of repetition, the court noted that it may be well to tabulate the stages of inquiry. It noted that there's a two-stage analysis that is involved, and I don't need to read that to you, Chairperson, honorable members. The issue of political sympathy is never envisaged by a law as the SAPS members have a constitutional obligation to enforce the law without fear, favor, or prejudice. This is informed by the provisions of Section 198C of the Constitution, which commands that national security must be pursued in compliance with the law, including international law. Section 199(5) also imposes an obligation on the security services, including the police, to act and teach and to require their members to act in accordance with the Constitution and the law, including customary international law and international agreements binding on the Republic. That is the point which you sought clarity on, Chairperson. The Constitutional Court has clarified this duty, the duty imposed by Section 39(2) of the Constitution, on the courts when interpreting legislation. It is necessary to ascertain the proper meaning of the relevant provisions in the Act. The Constitution requires that judicial officers read legislation, where possible, in ways which give effect to the fundamental values. Consistently with this, when the constitutionality of legislation is an issue, they are under a duty to examine the object and purport of an act and to read the provisions of the legislation insofar as is possible in conformity with the Constitution. Judicial officers must prefer interpretations of legislation that fall within constitutional bounds over those that do not, provided that such an interpretation can be reasonably ascribed to the fiction. It follows that where legislative provision is reasonably capable of a meaning that places it within constitutional bounds, it should be preserved. Only if this is not possible should one resort to a declaration of unconstitutionality. chairperson, and we need to stress that we consider the provisions of the bill. We are unable on this consideration to find any support for the arguments advanced by the CSVR. The bills in their present form do not contain any provisions in our view which can be subjected to constitutional attack on their own. In its submission, CSVR seems to attack the constitutionality of the bill on two grounds. Firstly, that the dissolution of the DSO and the concentration of investigative powers to the DSO will result in the elimination of the existing checks and balances exercised by the DSO to test and vice versa. Secondly, the disbandment of the DSO will lead to the elimination of a diversity of investigative agencies and will render the National Commission of Police and its senior management unaccountable to anyone, leading to them abusing their investigative powers. CSVR has not supported its submission with any legal authority to enable us to contextualize those. The only inference that we can draw from that is that CSVR's submission is based mainly on the perception of what would possibly happen should the DSO cease to exist as contemplated in the bill. The objections appear to be directed not at any specific provision in the bill, but at the policy decision itself. We may add, Chairperson, honorable members, that we believe that there are numerous checks and balances in the Constitution itself to address this. We do, though, Chairperson, take the liberty of making a final observation, and these are very short. One of the concerns raised in connection with the National Prosecuting Authority has been the exercise of the Minister's, grammatical error, final responsibility of that authority in terms of Section 179.6 of the Constitution. We had at the time of our consideration of the then draft of the National Prosecuting Authority Bill raised our concerns that the bill did not fully accommodate the provisions of Section 179.6. Chairperson, honourable members, we still hold that view. The prosecuting authority is neither part of the course in which the judicial authority is vested in terms of Section 165.1 of the Constitution. It is also not the Chapter 9 institution which supports or strengthens constitutional democracy. The constitutional standard applicable to the prosecuting authority is lower than that applied to those institutions and the courts. Section 206.1 of the Constitution states that the member of the cabinet must be responsible for policing and must determine national policing policy after consulting the provincial governments and taking into account the policing needs and priorities of the provinces as determined by the provincial executive. Section 207 provides, 1, the President as head of the National Executive must appoint a woman or a man as the National Commissioner of the Police Service to control and manage the police service. 2, the National Commissioner must exercise control over and manage the police service in accordance with the national policy, policing policy, and the directions of the Cabinet member responsible for policing, our emphasis. We submit that Sections 207 and 206 must be read together for the purposes of determining how supervision over the police is exercised by the executive. In our view, responsibility ultimately means control. In our considered view, the role of the minister responsible for policing should be considered in relation to the operations of the Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation if some of the criticisms currently levelled against the Scorpions are to be avoided. Thank you, Jesus.
So basically, can you summarize in a sense, simple sentence for a non-lawyer?
Yeah. For the non-lawyer cases, we are saying that this committee can confidently pass the two bills with or without any amendment.
Okay. They want. Okay. Now, for a non-lawyer, how would you explain the reply to the view that this is not a rational decision linked to a legitimate government purpose? I could see your reply to the equality clause. Basically, you're saying that the CSVR concerns must be taken into account, but it certainly doesn't constitute a constitutional breach. Okay, let's deal quickly with what you said. What I'm trying to say is that those of us who are lawyers, JVC, but you will read the text carefully, and I, too, and the co-chair will do that. What we want are simple, I'll be pleading with all the lawyers here, simple explanations that in Sweden or Germany or France or the United States Congress, the average member of parliament is not a lawyer. We are not constitutional experts. We need to be guided by you. But your task is to simplify matters. Now, as far as the equality clauses go, I'm able to follow what's being said. That actually, while their concerns are legitimate, I think is what Emma Daniels is saying, they are wrong to say that the equality clauses of the Constitution will be undermined if we go ahead with the TPCI. Is that correct? That's what you're saying. And the reasons are, give us three reasons quickly, or two reasons, simply. So we can engage politically.
You see, let me rather tell you how I interpret the CSVR. The CSV argument suggests that by taking the DSO, well, disbanding the DSO, you're now concentrating powers in the hands of the National Commissioner only. He places the National Commissioner above the law, and he can protect anybody he wants to protect. Now that is a fallacious argument with respect to the CSVR, because it overlooks the fact that executive control is exercised over the National Commissioner through the Minister, the Cabinet, and the President, and ultimately Parliament. And so that argument, in our respectful view, does not hold water. And it seems to me that argument has been put forward simply because of the difficulties that the current National Commission of Police is experiencing and some of the issues around that. We can't think of any other reason for saying that. Then the other most important attack on the bill is that they are saying that it's irrational to do so, and that ignores the fact that the Equality Act. Very quickly, Philip Jacobs, you were mainly responsible for this bill. Your response to the view that the Equality Clause of the Constitution be undermined. What is your reply?
Chair, I totally agree with what the Chief State Law Advisor has said. I really can't. I cannot add anything to my comment.
There you go, Chair. Well, at this stage, it's really a hypothetical argument. You can really not make any judgment on that. That will depend on facts to be established, like the and how the legislation is passed. At this stage, it's hypothetical.
You clearly belong to the same political party, which you have a mandate. You're scared to challenge the leader of your delegation and the delegate, because you might get expelled. Remember, the lawyers can disagree. We want their frank opinions. Good? So, people want to respond. Arguments of the lawyers is consensually that the Equality Clause is not undermined. Edward, can you send a copy via our committee secretary to CSVR? Send a reply. To all the people you've responded to, the committee section, well, not we used to, the committee section, can you send them the reply? Now, any questions about the issue of the Equality Clause? The argument is from all the lawyers that, hey, they have got legitimate concerns, but no, it's not unconstitutional. Any comments? No. Shall we move on? That issue is resolved. And addressed, not resolved. Secondly, the issue is legitimate. What? It's not a legitimate, it's not a rational decision linked to a legitimate government purpose. Respond, Emma.
Well, it is rational and legitimate. Certainly Parliament, if it's going to pass this bill, has the power to do that, and we said it. And what Parliament is doing is to say, well, maybe we need to locate this within SAPS, to strengthen SAPS' ability to deal with organized crime in accordance with the Constitution. That's rational and it's legitimate. Very simply, Chambers.
What about the view that, hey, the reason we're having this is simply because senior politicians of the majority party are being threatened by the Scorpions, and it's being dissolved for that reason. Secondly, it's a decision that was taken by a political party at its conference in December last year, and therefore it's irrational for the government to bring these bills before Parliament, because prior to December last year, there was no inkling or indication that the government's going to bring the bills to Parliament. And therefore, they hold the argument that it's linked to Paul Aguane, and therefore the government is simply, if you like, a subcommittee of the majority party. I'm crudifying it for the purposes of clarity. We want that sort of crisp answer. Right?
Yes, I did, in fact, in my paper, yeah, I dealt with it very succinctly. I think you mentioned you had left the room, chairperson. I didn't notice. But I do deal with the separation between the party and the state. It's dealt with in my paper, and I respectfully invite you to look at that, chairperson. It's dealt with succinctly.
Summarize it verbally now for us, so that we can move on. How would you do it?
Very simply, the executive, which exercises the executive authority between the president and the cabinet, has the power to initiate and develop national policy, irrespective as to what the ruling party decides. And it has exercised that executive authority in formulating the policy around these two bills and developing it and submitting this to Parliament for consideration.
Related question.
Sure.
Isn't the final issue, isn't it correct that whatever government may or may not have done, and however its decisions on these bills is related or not related to Polokwane, ultimately, bills belong to the purview of Parliament. And the real test is whether Parliament blindly and unconditionally implements the Polokwane decision, or, like in a list system, Maggie Sochu and I try to argue, there's a piece that appeared in the Sunday Times, was clipped quite a bit,
but not quite a bit, but I mean the central part, the central point we are making, and where he will help us with this. You see, in a proportionalist system, I'm sorry to be speaking so much, I just want to push the argument forward and then I'll retreat, okay? But I want to raise this question with you, Edna. In a proportionalist system, where members of parliament do not have specific constituencies, is it not reasonable? And what happens in established democracies, I'd like to know, where the system applies. Germany, where there's a PRM ward, but what happens to PR members? Isn't it correct that you get your mandate either via a five-year election or whatever, and the manifesto is what guides the majority party in its 5 years and the majority in a parliament? In between that, if you look at the case of December last year, it's the highest decision-making organ of the ANC, the majority party. 4,000 delegates, rightly or wrongly, they decided to dissolve the Scorpion. Now, the question that arises is, in between a five-yearly election, surely this wasn't an NEC decision, it wasn't a subcommittee of the NWC, surely members elected on a list system are accountable to the party, which they represent here, not a direct constituency. But, at the same time, members of parliament are members of parliament, and there are norms and values by which we have to have public hearings, and we have to take into account the views of the electorate. Therefore, the real challenge for us is how do you manage party mandates and parliamentary mandates to ensure that you have sound, constitutionally sound, fair, democratic public. That's the real challenge. It can apply to anybody. In fact, as somebody said yesterday or this morning, when in most of the cases that the bills that we've proceeded with here, let me give you an example here. You take the single metropolitan system of metropolitan municipalities. I was chair of local government at the time. We had a white paper, it is true, but the actual decision about having a single tier was made at a previous ANC five-yearly conference. Similarly, the same issue arises for the DA. In their case, or the ISP, they are also abiding by a party mandate to retain the Scorpions in the case of the DA. Now, they have to manage that mandate. In their case, I don't think it's the Federal Congress that decides it. I think it's the Parliamentary Caucus that decides it. Even less democratic in that sense. In their case, too, it applies. Right? No, what I'm trying to say is the Congress decides it. It's a larger, it's the delegate, it's the average rank and file member. It's the Parliamentary Caucus that decides it. They have to balance that against their mandate to have public hearings, and they must also be open to be convinced that maybe the majority in electors don't want the Scorpion. But isn't that a fundamental issue? Is there some guidance you can give us? How does a member of parliament in a list system manage a party mandate on the one hand and a parliamentary mandate on the other? You get the drift of what I'm saying.
Yes, I do. And of course, you're raising deep philosophical questions which are going to be difficult to answer here. But let me put it to you very simply, Chairperson, that the electorate has entrusted the running of this country to a particular party for a period of 5 years, which ends with the elections of next year. And what all the sociologists and philosophers and lawyers say is that if the electorate disagrees with what the current ruling party has done or is doing in any country for that matter, then it must punish the ruling party at the polls. In our system, we have a proportional system, as you know, at the national and provincial level. But that's neither here nor there. That doesn't stop the electorate from still punishing the ruling party if it so wishes. Of course, some people will say that it's easier to do so in a constituency-based system as in the municipal system which we have. That's also neither here nor there. I think the fundamental issue is the issue of whether the executive has simply rubber-stamped what happened at Polokwane. That is the issue. And that issue fundamentally ignores that even in a country like South Africa, which is a constitutional democracy, there is a separation between the state and the party. And you will know, Chairperson, as a member of the Communist Party, that Lenin and Marx and others wrote extensively on that separation between the party and the state. The argument holds true even for a constitutional democracy like ours. There is a separation between the party and the state. If Polokwane had simply sent its resolution to
technology, the ease that separation, and the cabinet, in terms of Section 85, has exercised executive authority, looked at it independently of Polokwane, and has developed and formulated policies which are incorporated in two draft bills before this committee. And I think that is the essential thing. Then, Chairperson, in our submission to you, we also deal with the legislative authority. Once the bills land up in Parliament, it is in Parliament which has the legislative authority to deal with those bills in any way it deems fit. In doing so, Chairperson, it obviously has to also take into consideration some of the public submissions, and it then needs to look at how it wants to tinker with the bill, if it indeed it wants to tinker, to take into account some of those arguments. We believe, Chairperson, that the most fundamental submission which has been made has been the submission by the CSVR around the equality argument. But in our view, they don't point to a single provision in those two bills which suggests that the equality provisions have been infringed in any way. Rather, they suggest that it puts the National Commission of Police on a pedestal above the purview of the law, and they're suggesting that the National Commissioner can then shield his friend. And that appears to be based on the National Commissioner's current difficulties. Therefore, we make an observation. We are saying to this committee, it's not our business to do so. We're saying, perhaps you need to look at the way in which the executive exercises control over the National Commissioner.
That's a matter we're going to address very quickly. Mulalani suggests that you slid in Lenin and Marx so that I'll get impressed by what you're saying. And I think, Mulalani, I'm 52 now. That would have impressed me at the age of 18. Secondly, I need to tell you, I mean, there's a journalist there sitting in the back who's smiling very broadly when you said that, hey, the problem would have been Polokwane gave us a resolution and we blindly went there. And it's also quite insulting, then, can I suggest? It's quite insulting to think that somehow this caliber of people here, right, will just blindly, like, go ahead and, you know, desperately implement things unconditionally. But you must respond to that sometime. Can I put this to Philip and John very quickly?
Honestly, let me just say, I said if the ruling party had some.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't say that.
Yeah. The journalist is just smiling. I have no reason why, but I noticed that. I think he was quite skeptical of what you're saying, which is right. Philip and Johan, very quickly. Thing about legitimate purpose linked to a rational decision.
Chair, maybe on a totally practical level, on the logic behind the decision. And if I can refer to just a few words, command, control, accountability, and coordination. One of the main issues that the Competitive Commission discussed was relating to what the Commission called the disjunction in ministerial responsibilities. And with all respect, the proposal by the Gompepe Commission that the DSO must be remain located with the NPA, but the Minister for Safety and Security must take accountability for them, is an issue that would not have solved the issue of ministerial disjunction, and which not only related to the police service, but also to the intelligence services and the intelligence function. By placing the DSO within the SAPS, you clearly solve those issues about command, control, accountability, and coordination.
Yes,
very briefly, I think the matter is rather simple. I might be crucified in some court for saying it. When Parliament passed legislation in 2000, establishing the DSO, there was a government purpose associated with it. Parliament is now asked again to pass legislation pertaining to the DSO, but the government purpose at the time was perceived to be an effort by government to enhance the fight against crime, specifically organized crime at the time. We've now had a period of 8 years since we've had problems. We've had a competitive commission, and the executive had to struggle with recommendations which were based on that commission. I know the issue started by various perceptions, generalized statements, etc., but the executive had one solid thing to work on, and that was competitive and the recommendations. And that will, in our view, always remain the most reliable text. Not all these statements, etc. And it's loaded with sentiment from both sides. So then government had to make up its mind how it's going to take the matter forward. If the government purpose now is to achieve what we sought to achieve in 2000, in other words, enhance the fight against crime by improving
question. If it is proved on a balance of probabilities or whatever that the purpose was to protect people from being, I don't think there's much argument that that would probably not pass that test.
Presumably also, until you see, if we decide to go that route, what the new model is, it's very difficult to tell whether it's a legitimate purpose and whether it's rational. How do you know that the new unit, even if it's located within the SAPS, might not turn out to be even more effective? So it's premature to say. Wouldn't that be a reasonable argument? Okay, let's throw it open then on this issue of legitimate purpose, rigor, rational decision. Anyone to comment? Yeah, let's.
Thank you, Chair. I want to come back to the separation between political party and the state. Now, I think the point has been very well put, but in practice, if the decision or the resolution was not taken at Polokwane, would we have had these bills before us at this stage?
Any other comments? Right. Can you reply? Oh.
I do believe that the proportional representation means that people are belonging to parties. Therefore, the fallback of any ruling party or any party who is in charge of the government fall back to the party that members fall back to the party that elected them. Therefore, the basis of saying that the legislation can differ from what the party thinks may be a thin line in between. Because what the party thinks, at the end of the day, you can just use different words and making sure that that resolution is being passed. What is the difference?
Okay. Do Bilal, you say anything? JJ.
Just really the Khampepe recommendation of the...
No, sorry.
Maybe I've gone too quickly.
So it was just the it's just the this recommendation of transferring political oversight and responsibility over the law enforcement component of the DSO to the Minister of Safety and Security. Maybe it's to Commissioner Jacobs. I've heard what he said. I mean, I've problems with it. But I mean, how is that actually practical? How would that work in terms of budgetary issues and like that? So was it, I mean, it might sound nice, but was it actually practically implementable, given that if the DSO with the NPA and they fall under the budget of the of Department of Justice, how then can you have political oversight over a section? Can you have that political oversight without the budgetary issues, if that's the main linkage? With the executive, yeah, just how would that have worked? I know he doesn't agree with it, but so maybe also, yeah, but or maybe somebody else could also comment on it, but could it have ever worked?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I do agree with Baba Dlovu. I might sound crude. Why do people vote for a particular party? Is it because their hands are more beautiful? No. They vote for a particular party because of its policies, which must be implemented. And where are the policies being made? In the party conferences. So there's absolutely nothing wrong. The only difference between the ANC and the DA in particular is because policies of the DA, they end up in their drawers. They will never be implemented. That is the major difference. We go to conferences, we develop policies so that those policies can be implemented. The issue is whether what the state advisor is saying, the issue is whether the executive applies its mind in terms of implementing those policies and the parliament applies its mind. But even in America, they're going for elections now.
say that they will strengthen the scorpions. And now at the conference they take a different view. So we would have said, rather now you're approaching an election, let's go back to the people who gave you that mandate and say, look, we've changed our mind, now you can decide it. So, thank you.
But can I ask a question? You see, I know this argument, right? And I want to say this very quickly. You see, what you're saying implies that only between a 5-yearly election period, when you go to the elected, can you make major decisions. Otherwise, you know, your 4,000-member Congress or whatever is not sufficiently appropriate to take a decision. I think we'll agree to disagree on that. Because otherwise it means the party is moribund. You can do nothing until you get an election and you have an election manifesto. Secondly, why is it true that in the 2004 manifesto, the ANC said that it is also true that congresses of the ANC took certain other decisions? And sometimes, you know, it's a balance of forces within the party about who shapes the manifesto against the balance of forces in the political party that takes the decision at rank and file level, and don't necessarily correspond, not just in our party always, but in other parties. Thirdly, actually, a party can take a decision that we went to the electorate on this particular issue and we said we're going to do this, but we're not waiting for the next election. What we're going to do is take a decision in between an election, and then with an election coming, the masses can decide whether they disagree or agree with us. And that's the point I think Enver makes. The ultimate sanction is the vote in a democracy. That will be our three replies to you. But you can come back and reply only in a philosophical debate, and I think we must agree to disagree on that. I would have been much more nervous, quite frankly, as a chair of a parliamentary committee, and I'm sure it applies to all chairs, if it was a small subcommittee of the NEC that took the decision and so on. I do think, though, that we need to apply our mind as to how you balance party mandate and parliamentary mandate in a democracy. And that's something we need to apply our mind to. You know, we have to apply our mind to. I think the issue really is not that the party cannot provide a mandate to the parliamentary MP. It is about the level of detail which the mandate is provided from the political party that is at issue. How detailed should it be? That's the issue, I think. Having said that, we've rounded up. It's time to go for lunch almost. And I thought that we're going to move faster now because I think we're getting a rhythm now. And I think all the contributors are understanding we do not want written text to be read. Summarize them quickly and draw us to the relevant paragraph, section of the relevant paragraph. But please, we're not going to read text. Otherwise, we'll never get here. And our aim is by next Tuesday to have completed this entire 18 thing and move on. So having said that, it's lunch. The ANC is going to be meeting for those who are relevant only. JJ is telling that. And where's that? That's in V16. Right. And we know where to be there. The rest of us are back at 2 and we'll finish at 4. We'll move faster this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Smells of burning gum. Sitting and popping. Can you believe it? Okay. Hi, Lindsay.